So tonight's topic is the Kaka Kupama Sutta. I just wanted to say that because it's such a fun name, I think. And the translation that is the simile of the saw, which interestingly is only the very last part of the whole sutta, the simile of the saw. But that's how it got named, because it's the most dramatic of the similes. And this is really a whole series of teachings on right action and right speech. The two of the three steps of the Eightfold Path, and that involve living in the world. And it's all about how we react to what other people say and do. That's what this whole sutta is about, all the various things. And it's often areas where we interact with other people, we can be quite reactive. And we can, without too much difficulty at all, start responding and acting very righteously, and which very quickly turns into self-righteously if we're not careful, of course. So I'm going to read parts of the Sutta. I've got lots of other things to read in relation to this, but this it starts out. And I won't read the very first few verses, but there's this bhikkhu, this monk called Phaguna, who's hanging out with the bhikkhunis, which in the context of him being a monk is not cool. Though before I started reading, the interesting thing is the Buddha was quite radical actually in his time, in that he took women into the sangha. This was considered odd by his contemporaries, who basically believed, oh, women, well, maybe next time they'll get lucky and get a male body. But other than that, sorry, you should just, stay home and, cook and take care of the kids and the cows, right? That was sort of the general attitude about women. But the Buddha took them in regularly. And often the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus would live in the same space almost, but they would have separate quarters, but they would interact to a certain degree. And there would be times, actually, interestingly enough, when a senior bhikkhu would be assigned to teach the bhikkhunis, and every once in a while there'd be a senior bhikkhuni who would teach the bhikkhus, which was also quite radical in the day. Anyhow. So that's the sort of a little bit of the background of the culture of the time. And so much and how he was doing it. And so he was saying, this is what the Buddha said, Phaguna, is it true you are associating overmuch with bhikkhunis? That you are associating so much with bhikkhunis that if a bhikkhu speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating so much with bhikkhunis as it seems? Yes, venerable sir, answered Bhikkhuna. Phaguna, are you not a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from home life into the homelessness? Yes, venerable sir. Phaguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected. I shall not utter evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. That is how you should train Paguna. And then he goes on and says exactly the same thing for the bhikkhunis in reverse. So, on one level, when we think about it, it seems kind of odd. You know, it's like someone's, you know, not treating the bhikkhunis correctly, you know, and Paguna is defending them, and vice versa. The problem is two, and the Buddha is making two points here. Because they have gone forth, because they have become monks and nuns, their way of interacting in the world should be distinctly different. And they shouldn't, as a householder would, defend, like he's defending these poor defenseless women in the culture of the day. That's the, wouldn't be the attitude. And vice versa, the bhikkhunis defend him because he's taking care of us, you know. And that's also the attitude of householders. And what the Buddha is saying is, no, you can't. You have to stand on your own. That's what he's saying to the bhikkhunis. You have to be able to be strong and stand on your own. You don't need anybody, any man, to defend you. And as a bhikkhu, you shouldn't take it upon yourself to take care of the bhikkhunis in this way. It's not your role anymore. And the other layer of this is, on both cases, the, you know, Paguna or the bhikkhunis, when they were doing this defense, would get angry. So they were, an unwholesome mind state was arising. And they should have been able to stay unaffected by what was going on. Even if someone was saying something bad about the bhikkhunis or disparaging them, Paguna should be able to just stay calm, and vice versa. In our lives as householders, since we're not bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, this almost seems rather strange. It's like, well, you know, it's our job to sort of help each other out, et cetera, et cetera. But so how does this apply to us out here in the householder world where we live and breathe? And there's an English phrase I like, a phrase that sort of suits. And for us, this is about staying in our own lane. Yeah. Sometimes it might be appropriate for us to say something in a certain situation to defend something or someone. But often, you know, if we're not careful, and especially if we're saying it or acting out of anger, that's the key for us householders. If we're acting out of anger, it'll never be appropriate. We can't act out of anger. You know, because we act from that place of anger, what happens is then more anger arises. I'll give you a concrete example, and this is from my own experience this teaching came to mind, actually. And I mean, I was at Home Depot, where I spend a lot of time, you know, getting stuff because I'm building things all the time. And I went in there, and there's two younger men and an older woman sort of coming in at the same time as me, just ahead of me. And I noticed that the older woman didn't have a mask on. And it was like, you know, it was like, why, you know, and my impulse was to go up and say something to her. But, and there was a little, it's like, you know, you're supposed to be wearing a mask, what's wrong with you? Energy going on there. So it was partly, but it was very, it had a, I could see the tinge of sort of self-righteousness in it. At the same time, it was like, well, it's not a good idea for her to be in here without a mask. You know, there's big signs at the door, blah, blah, blah. And I realized it wasn't my lane. If I went and did, first of all, even if I approached them not from a place of anger, if I was calm and sort of cool and just, you know, I'm concerned, you know, I'm an older person, I have, you know, pre-existing conditions, you not wearing a mask puts me in danger, you know, I'd like you to wear a mask. So I approached them from that sort of place. The chances are she or the two younger men who were with her would get angry. Who's this guy, this old guy interfering? And, you know, and so it wasn't that, there's that potential. And also it was the job of the lane of the people who work at Home Depot to be doing that, not me. So even if I sort of felt like quite righteously I should be saying something, just wasn't correct. It wasn't appropriate for me to be doing that. And this is a delicate thing in our world, because there are times when we do have to act and speak. It just didn't make sense that this was going to be the way it was going to be. So my headphones are making funny noises, so I'm going to take them off and go to standard speaker here.
Can you still hear me? Yes? Okay, good. So just sometimes these headphones get weird. So basically, that's that first level. The other level, in terms of the nuns and the monks that I want to mention, is that their mutual duty, their primary duty, in fact, from the Buddhist point of view, their main and only duty is the practice. Not that sort of hang out together, not to sort of gossip or whatever, you know, is going on. And that acting in defense of the other party is a way of sort of creating more sense of self, creating more sense of there's someone who's speaking harshly, and I self have to do something about it. It's there's a great phrase one of my teachers said once when he talked about anger in particular, that always has stayed with me, that applies here. And I said, it's all anger. And this is something the Buddha said, all anger arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. All anger. And think about it, in this case, you know, there was the, I don't know if there was like physical lust between the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, but there was the desire to be looked upon as, you know, important. I'm taking care of the bhikkhunis. That becomes a desire pretty quickly if we're not careful. And the wounded pride is like, and then, you know, who are these people to complain about me doing this? I'm doing the right thing. I'm so wonderful. You know, those are the places where, if we see ourselves getting angry out here in the world, or in our minds as we're sitting, it's quite a skillful thing to ask, where's the thwarted lust in this lust in this case means in the broadest sense of a strong wanting to do something, or wounded pride. Is there an aspect of that in what's going on here? And often when you look closely, that's what you see. You see one of those two flavors arising. I also want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation, here. And this is, he's talking about this topic in a slightly different way, perhaps. Our great challenge and potential is to learn how to stay open to the whole range of feeling without adding this extra sense of I and mine in the midst of it. You know, not identifying as I'm the one who's angry, or I'm the one who should be angry, perhaps. One practical advice that often helps is to see three things are going on in the midst of strong emotion. When we become angry, for example, first there is some external situation prompting the anger to arise. Someone is doing or saying something we don't like, or we feel is harmful to ourselves or others. Second, there is our reaction to that situation, namely the feeling of anger. And the third component is the relationship of our mind to the anger itself. Interesting. It's not something you don't think about, no? Usually we are lost in the first two, the external situation and our reaction to it. Something happens, we get angry. As we get angry, we start thinking about what happened. All those thoughts create more anger, which in turn creates more thoughts about the situation, often with blame, self-righteousness, and hurt feelings. Thus, we quickly become caught in a destructive loop. If we seek a way out of such cycles, try turning your attention away from the situation and your reaction to it and towards the third component, the relationship of your mind to the emotion, whether it is anger, fear, or whatever. For example, in the midst of the whirlwind of anger, you might ask yourself, how am I getting caught in this anger? How am I being hooked by it? How am I identifying with it? And so this question I suggested of, you know, is there thwarted lust or wounded pride going on here? Asking someone of that question is completely different from considering the external situation. At such a time, we are no longer sending out threads of blame that bind us to the situation, to the reaction, to our identification with the emotion. We are no longer thinking about the external causes of the anger, so we are no longer feeding it. We also do not ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer. Interesting. We also don't ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer or having an intellectual response. Rather, the question's purpose is to help us change perspective, to take responsibility for what arises in our mind. In the moment of asking, how am I getting hooked? We've already moved outside the anger and are looking at the way we are relating to it. It is possible in that moment for the whole mass of anger to dissolve without our denying it, repressing it, or shoving it away, which is, of course, important. And we don't, and just we go from, otherwise you just go from one form of aversion to another. So this is, I think this is an interesting instruction, both for life and in meditation practice, that we can, when we get caught in those whirlwinds of anger, to stop and ask this question. And that's my question, like, what's going on is another version of that question. Like, how am I getting caught is Joseph's version here. It's just a way of going, oh, wait a second. I don't have to be caught in this whirlwind. I can step outside. Another little tidbit. When I was involved in a yoga organization many years ago, the sage who had passed away by the time I joined the organization, Swami Sivananda, had this very famous quote that was, you'd see it painted on the walls of the ashrams and things like that. It was, bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. Interesting, huh? Bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. And it doesn't mean you should let people control you or beat you up, or it means that at times you just have to sort of grin and bear it. Like, take it in and not react, because the reaction just amplifies things. You know, this, so when we don't want to get caught in, you know, righteous anger, which is often where anger has that flavor of wounded pride in particular. Somehow we think because it's righteous anger, because what we're thinking is right, it's okay to express that anger. This is politics 101, basically, in our world. But we need to, and at the same time, we have to remember, it is important that we defend others who are in need of being defended, but we have to do it from a place not of anger or blame. Like, we still have a duty in the world to take care of things in the world around us. We just have to be very careful not to be self-righteous about it. I'm right, they're wrong, those bad people, which is where our mind goes if we're not careful. Okay. So then there's another couple more verses I want to read here now. And just sort of work our way through this sutta. And so this is, this whole sutta is like a collection of these pieces. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, there was an occasion when a bhikkhu satisfied my mind. Here I address the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, I eat at a single session. By doing so, I am free from illness and affliction and enjoy lightness, strength, and comfortable abiding. Come, bhikkhus, eat at a single session. By so doing, you will be free from illness and affliction. You will enjoy lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. And I had no need to keep on instructing those bhikkhus. I had only to arouse mindfulness in them. And then he goes on. Therefore, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states, for that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Suppose there were a big sala tree grove near a village or town, and it was choked with castor oil weeds, and some man would appear desiring its good, welfare, and protection. He would cut down and throw out the crooked saplings that rob the sap, and he would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight, well-formed saplings so that the sala tree grove later on would come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So too, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states. For that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. So here he's just simply talking, pointing out that we have to be active in our practice of sila. This isn't something we can sort of just take for granted. I mean, we have to like pull out the weeds and cut out the crooked saplings. And that means we have to look and see them, be mindful of them, be aware of them. Not in this sort of self-condemning, oh, I'm so full of unwholesome things way. Just constructively go, oh, I can see this is not wholesome, not this is harmful. I'm just gonna abandon that. Abandon is one of the Buddha's favorite words when he talks about this stuff. We have to abandon the unwholesome. And that's I just wanted to mention this simile because it's an interesting one. It's interesting that Buddha, often when he uses similes, are things that in his culture at that time, everybody would understand, because pretty much everybody still lived in villages. And so there'd be, you know, a grove of sala trees out there by the edge of the village. So they would understand exactly what he was talking about, so that the image would be very powerful because it was immediately relatable. And I don't even know what a sala tree is. I sort of convert this into a grove of, you know, pine trees or something like that. But it's the same image. You know, you have to sort of tending your garden, essentially. Yeah, that image. Then there's another great story here. This is, I'm not even going to read this, because this is a story about a woman, Mistress Vedika, was always calm and peaceful and graceful, and the whole village looks up to her. She's just so wonderful, right? But her maid, she has a maid, Kali. probably an interesting name coming from the Hindu tradition that I do. Kali was the goddess of destruction. Interesting that he would choose that name for this story. That would be a culture he grew up in. And Kali is thinking, yeah, I don't think she's really this really virtuous person. I think this is all a big act. So one morning she comes to work a little late. And the mistress doesn't say much. She sort of looks at her sideways. And then the next day she comes even later. And now the mistress sort of says, well, you know, Kali, you know, it's your job to be here. Sort of gives her some sort of stern instructions, but still stays sort of very cool about the whole thing. And Kali just keeps doing this, coming later and later every time. And then finally, at one point, her mistress just loses it completely, picks up a rolling pin, whacks her on the head. It's like a big scene. And then Kali goes out into the village and says, look, look what Mistress Vedeka did to my head. And she hit me with the rolling pin, and everybody's shocked. So what's this all about? This is about the idea that people put on holiness, put on this calm exterior, you know. And partly it's, you know, people get caught in this in the Buddhist world into thinking somehow or other, that's how they always have to be. I have to have this calm exterior all the time, because that's what Buddhists look like. Right? They're always calm. So I have to appear calm all the time. And partly it's like they do it because they get praise for this, of course. It's like she, like this woman, she was like, everybody in the village thought she was so wonderful because she's so calm all the time. The other thing is the real test of calm, the real test of how calm and peaceful you are, isn't when things are easy. It's when things aren't going well. When you're getting dissed, you're getting bothered by someone, someone's pushing your buttons. That's the test of how peaceful and calm you are and how peaceful and calm your mind is. And if you just try to always look holy, but it's an external show, there's always going to come a time when something comes along that's beyond your capability to deal with, and then often the opposite happens, there's just a big explosion, like her mistress hitting her on the head with a rolling pin. Yeah, that's where things go if we're not careful. If we're trying to act holy, but we're not being holy, being two different things, then we have to be very careful, because this is actually quite a problem in the Buddhist world, I think, this thing of acting like a holy person, you know, wearing the right clothes and, you know, doing the right things and reading the right books, and it can fall into this external appearance. And we have to be aware that we're not going there, that we're not thinking we're better, because we're so holy, which is where that energy often comes from. It comes from the, because I'm so holy, I'm better than all those unwashed masses of not Buddhist meditator people. Because it's not true at all. It's just, we've just chosen this one particular way to practice that suits us. And I look in my younger days, I looked at lots of different forms of practice before I finally found this one. And it's just there's nothing that makes this one better than any other one. Just this is how we're operating right now, and it's fine. Then the Buddha gives in this next section probably his most well-known teaching on speech. This is when you see quoted and or distorted in memes on Facebook and places like that all the time. See it written on the walls of Dharma halls and things like that. Bhikkhus, there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh. When others address you, their speech may be connected with good or with harm. When others address you, their speech may be spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Herein, because you should train thus, our minds will remain unaffected and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So a lot of that isn't usually quoted. Usually it's just often you just see this whole thing reduced to, you know, your speech should be wholesome, timely, true, gentle, and connected with good, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness, which is all great advice. And it's a practice, you know, of being mindful when we speak, that's where what we're saying is, that's the space what we're saying is coming from. But he turns it around and he also says, but if people speak to you in the opposite way, that's no reason why you shouldn't still have metta for them. Still shouldn't have a heart full of loving kindness. You shouldn't other them, essentially, to use contemporary language. It's so easy to do that. It's so easy to get caught judging others by how they're speaking to you. And then now you're falling into aversion. Now you're and into sort of self-righteousness, if we're not careful. Here's another thing I want to read here related to this. This is Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. He's talking about mindful listening. And we always think about right speech, right? But listening is half of speech. It's an interesting way to think about it. How we listen should be just as mindful as how we speak. So, right speech also has implications for how we listen. The Buddha outlined a practice for staying mindful of how another person is addressing us without getting caught up in our own reactivity. And even more than that, he enjoins us to abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness. Listening with compassion and loving kindness, even when harsh or untrue words are addressed to us, is a tremendously challenging aspect of mindfulness. last 4 years have been a fine example of how challenging this is. And it's a good example of what it means to be mindful externally as well as internally. Although such listening may seem very difficult to accomplish, in fact, many parents demonstrate it easily with their young children. Children in moments of frustration or upset will yell at their parents, "I hate you." I speak from experience here. And yet, for many parents, at least much of the time, the response remains loving. This practice would transform the world if people would begin to apply it throughout their lives. Just by mindful listening and not getting caught by people speaking in a way that isn't timely, it isn't true, it isn't gentle, it isn't connected with good, and it isn't spoken with loving kindness. And it's quite an interesting though, when you think about it, that it probably means, if you really start to look at it, look at those five things before you speak, you'll speak a lot less. It would be very interesting. And I also want to mention that speech in our culture includes things we write, especially things we write on the internet. Yeah. If you want to see unmindful speech, just go on to a lot of internet threads. It's like scary what's out there in that world. And so we have to remember that is now a major part of our speech. Even though we're not saying anything out loud, we're still speaking as we type away. And so we want to be aware of that. And then the Buddha gives these great images in the next section of this sutta. Where he gives these sort of fantastical images to make us understand, in a sense, about how we want to deal with people who are speaking disagreeably. Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, "I shall make this great earth to be without earth." He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, "Be without earth, be without earth." What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man make this great earth be without earth? "No, venerable sir." "Why is that?" "Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment." So this is like a simile, an image of someone speaking not speaking skillfully. You see this all the time, people claiming they're going to do something, they're going to change the world. They figured out the best way to do things. It's like digging the earth, thinking you're going to be able to take all the dirt away. Never going to happen. Then he has two other images here. They're also kind of interesting. Bhikkhus, suppose a man with crimson, turmeric, and indigo or carmine and said, "I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space." So this is a list of normal things people used to dye cloth in those days. "I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space?" "No, venerable sir." "Why is that?" "Because empty space is formless and non-manifestive. It is not easy to draw pictures there to make pictures appear. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment." And then he has one more here. "Bhikkhus, suppose a man came upon a blazing grass torch and said, 'I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges.' with his blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could the man heat up and burn away the river, the Ganges, with that blazing torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat it up or burn it away with a blazing grass torch. These are all images to make us understand that when someone's speaking to us disagreeably, they're coming from a place of delusion. These are all these acts that are delusional acts, right? I'm going to, you know, evaporate the river Ganges, or I'm going to dig away all the earth, or I'm going to, you know, draw things in air and they're going to stay there. These are examples of delusional thought. And when someone is speaking harshly to us, someone is speaking inappropriately to us, pretty much always there's some layer of delusional thought involved in what they're saying, where they're coming from. Okay, I'm going to read a couple of other things here. This is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. I'm just talking about how to deal with this situation I've been talking about. How can we let go in such a situation? How can we change it? We can focus our attention more on the suffering of the situation, both our own and the suffering of others, rather than on our anger. We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. It's a good question. We think about anger, right? We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. Mostly what we are angry at is the anger of the other person. When someone approaches us from that space, mostly what we're doing is we're like offended by that anger. And that makes us, and that brings our anger energy up. It is almost as if the other person were an instrument for anger that moves through them and motivates them to act in unskillful ways. We do not become angry at somebody's mouth when they are shouting at us. We are angry at the anger that is motivating them to shout. That's a great line. Huh? We do not become angry at somebody's mouth when they are shouting at us. We are angry at the anger that is motivating them to shout. If we add anger to anger, we only serve to increase it. In a well-known phrase, the Buddha said, hatred can never cease by hatred. Hatred can only cease by love. This is an eternal law. Another one of those meme-like famous quotes of the Buddha. So then we come. We almost came. There's something here in the Dhammapada which I love. I came across. I really like this as well. So this is the Buddha speaking to this gentleman, Atula. This has come down from old Atula, and not from just the day. They find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There's no one unfaulted in the world. There never was, will be, nor at present is found, anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. So this is interesting because basically what the Buddha is saying here is this is inevitable. Someone is going to diss you. Someone's going to complain about what you're doing or how you're doing it or what you're saying, no matter what. You know, it's like the example he uses of, you know, somebody sitting silent, people, oh, he's sitting there silent. Who the hell does he think he is, right? Someone talks too much. Oh, he talks, I talk too much. And then someone finds, well, who measures his words? Oh, he's too cautious in how he speaks. He's sort of, someone's going to complain about something, no matter how you do it, no matter how you live your life. There's going to be people who find fault. It's inevitable as the sun coming up in the morning. And so we should understand that too. that we're never going to be in a situation where people aren't finding fault. It just ain't ever going to happen. So that approaching all of that from that space of loving kindness is interesting and important. And finally, right at the last, we come to the simile of the saw, which is what this whole sutta is named, right? The very, almost the very last verse. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for the welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So he's saying to the bhikkhus, this is would be not applied to us as helpful holders, but to a certain degree. He's saying to the bhikkhus, even if someone's trying to cut you in half with a saw and cut off your limbs, you shouldn't react from a place of anger. That's how strong your practice has to be. And this seems like, oh my God, you got to be kidding. But there's a really well-known example of this. This is a story that the Dalai Lama tells. You know, Dalai Lama escaped in 59. He escaped from Dharamsala and made his way across the Himalayas and ended up in northern India where he set up his operation. But not all the monks that he was in the group he was part of in the Sangha got out. Many of them were captured and were treated quite horribly, tortured, sometimes for very, very long times. And so anyhow, this monk who had been one of the ones who had been captured and got out and escaped, he was left for like 20 years in prison. And made his way and got to the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai, it was like an old buddy of the Dalai Lama's, right? Shows up and the Dalai Lama is like so happy to see him. And he's like, then he asks, is there anything you want to tell me about your time there in the prison? And it's okay to talk about it. And the monk says, "Oh, I was very afraid." And the Dalai Lama says, "Well, of course, you know, you're being tortured, and these people are beating you, and it's natural to be afraid of that." And the monk says, "No, it wasn't that. I was afraid I'd get angry at them. 20 years." So this is, it seems like, well, you got to be kidding, that is impossible. But here's this monk, 20 years, and his big worry was that he might get angry at the people who were ill-treating him. That was his big problem. So it's interesting. The flip side of this, and now I want to be very careful, is this is what we're talking about here are practices. These are things we have to practice. It isn't about we have to be perfect. It's that we have to practice towards that level of perfection that monk emblifies. And not be concerned if we're not perfect and we're not there yet. We're just All the stuff around speech and action, how we act, and particularly how we speak in the world, it's all about practice, about being aware. And so this is where mindfulness in the real world is central to the whole thing. This is where mindfulness is really a strength when we live in the world and interact with the world, that we act in those ways so that, you know, we are actually always speaking and interacting from a place of loving kindness. And from this, and when we're speaking, what we're saying is timely, it's true, it's gentle, it's connected with good, and spoken with the mind of loving kindness. This is not easy. But it's like, this is where, if we apply our mindfulness practice to how we live in the world, this is where we can, there's a lot of work we can do here by actually being mindful in our daily lives and to the benefit of the world. This is, if we want to have less suffering in the world, boy, here's a way we can really help create a world with less suffering, just by paying attention to what comes out of our mouth. I mean, speech is a huge issue for the Buddha. You know, if you look at, there it is in the Eightfold Path. It's also this teaching called, you know, the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. The top 10, right? 4 of the top 10 are about speech. Just speech. So this is like, the Buddha understood how this is a place where so much suffering arises in the world, both for ourselves and for others. And so it's where we have to really start applying our mindfulness to that speech. It makes a big difference. But it's not about being perfect. That's the other thing we have to keep remembering. It's not about being perfect. It's about working towards that. And that's, because otherwise we end up, this becomes again a very sophisticated way of beating ourselves up. Oh, there I was, not speaking mindfully again. Stupid me. Blah, blah, blah. Now we're just traded one unwholesome mind state for some nice aversive mind state instead. Instead of just learning from the fact, oh, there's a situation where I got caught. I should be a bit more mindful when I see a situation like that arising about my tendencies to speak in unwholesome ways. And with some situations and some relationships, of course, this is very difficult. And that's part of life too. So I'm going to pause here and ask if there are any questions or anything that anybody would like to say. And so if you have things you want to share or things you want to talk about or ask any questions about this, now's I'm sort of opening the floor to that interactive level. And as always, don't feel that you need to say or do anything. But Billy's waving his hand, sir. Go ahead, Billy.
All right, hopefully I can make this make sense. So I remember this originally from basketball, and I've also noticed this in different social settings where I'll bring the intention of being mindful in the activity out in the world, and it's instead become a form of rigidness, and I can find myself almost like being an actor trying to play the part of someone mindful, as you had mentioned during the talk. Mm-hmm. So I've experimented with, you know, at some point I got frustrated. I was okay, I'm just going to sit and I'm going to show up in the world and be myself, and hopefully the mindfulness will show up when it shows up. But then that can get really loose. So I'm just curious if you have any insight on that problem of when you're trying to force yourself to be mindful, and almost like I lost my personality and my fluidity in the world because I was, it became like a form of self-criticism, and I was trying to be a quiet, kind of like you said.
I think this is where the middle path are very appropriate. It's like, Yeah, we have to be mindful, but not to the point where we're suppressing our natural exuberance or our natural whatever. And it's a delicate thing. And the only way we can learn that is it's a practice like anything else, right? So we can try and be mindful in the world. We can try and, especially in situations where we know we could be very easily caught up in not being so mindful. Maybe we're a little more hyper aware in those situations. And in other situations that are just sort of like hanging out, being with your partner and your mother or whatever, just it's like that hyper vigilance may not be so essential. And so it's finding that balance between those two edges that you just described. And that's just practice. I have no great words of wisdom at all, other than the fact that you're aware that that's an important thing to do, that's very wholesome. Give yourself cred for that. And the fact that you are aware that, oh, I should be mindful in this situation, that's a very wholesome place to come from. And then try and just sort of, at the same time, be mindful of yourself not being so gentle with yourself. Mix the mindfulness with a little self-compassion.
Okay, I don't want to take up too much time, but one more quick one. So on another day-long retreat, you mentioned that mindfulness isn't necessarily something you do. It's you creating the causes and conditions to where mindfulness might arise,
yeah.
Right? How does that relate to being in the world? I see almost like a difference there where you're trying to cultivate mindfulness while you're walking into, say, Home Depot versus on a meditation retreat, you're just creating the causes and conditions so that mindfulness might arise.
Yeah. It's like there's a micro version of what we're talking about, like that actually, like as we're sitting and we're doing what we think of as our practice, that's sort of the micro moment to moment version of what you're talking about. But then out in the world, it's more like, oh, I've done a lot of practice. My mind is sort of tending in this direction. So it's more likely that I'll be mindful in my daily life. And that's it's a broader macro version as opposed to the micro moment to moment sitting doing practice level.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So you should, you did mute. Thank you, Billy. And other questions, thoughts? It's okay. If you remember, like I always say, it's always okay. Okay. I, of course, have one more thing I want to do. and that's to read a little poetry here. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called Awakening Now. And it has actually some relationship to that self-critical voice you were talking about, Billy. So maybe I picked this for you, who knows. Awakening now. Why wait for your awakening? The moment you open, your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid, and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening. I think that there's that one line that always struck me as so powerful. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. That's great advice. Dedicate the merit of our practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.